Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we'll be looking at issues ranging from human rights to civil rights. We're joined by John Gold, author of We Were Lied To About 9/11, and As the Drums of War Beat for Iran, we're reminded why 9/11 still matters. We'll take a special look at 9/11 victims and first responders. Also, we'll hear the testimony of TV personality John Stewart, who spoke to Congress recently about their lack of support for funding 9/11 first responder health issues. Later in the program, we'll be joined once again by Gregory Joey Johnson from the landmark Texas v. Johnson 1989 Supreme Court case that said burning the flag is a protected right. Of course, Joey Johnson was also part of the RNC 16 from the 2016 Republican Convention and recently won a settlement from the city of Cleveland on related matters. Please stay with us.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies like an ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. In the first segment today, we're rejoined by author and activist John Gold. His latest book is We Were Lied To About 9/11, and he's an activist for justice for 9/11 victims and first responders. John Gold is responsible for doing an amazing series of interviews with over 30 people, various experts on the events of September the 11th, and you can check that out as a podcast. You can also check out the printing of it. It is called We Were Lied To About 9/11. And John, of course, has been a guest on the program before, and there's been some things happening around the events of 9/11 in the not-so-distant past. But I know that one of the reasons John Gold wanted to come on and talk to our audience again was mainly to talk about why the events of September the 11th, 2001, still matter. What we may know about them, what we may not know about them, questions that aren't being asked, evidence and publications of things that have simply been ignored. And like many controversial watershed moments in our history, these issues, these events, they attract a lot of attention. And not all of the attention is good attention. Of course, we've seen government studies and commission studies trying to explain the events of 9/11 that have been riddled with holes and have had a lot of accuracy issues. Then we've also seen a lot of speculation and theorizing that actually goes outside of responsible reporting because it's not based on tangible factual evidence. John Gold, I like to think, is the person that helps straddle that world, knows how to ask the right questions, knows how to dig deep for the facts and information, but also has a great detector for when not to go too far afield into the realm of wanton speculation or pretending that because one needs something to be true or believes something that it automatically is supported. And that's, again, what I think is one of the great benefits of John Gold's work. And if you haven't seen or heard yet, I would urge you to check out his publication and his podcast, We Were Lied To About 9/11, to see just exactly what he means by that. But you're going to get a sneak peek here today because John Gold is joining us on the program again. John Gold, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hey, Mickey and Chase, how are you guys doing today?
We're doing all right. John, I know you've been an activist on this issue for such a long time, particularly for the first responders, for the victims' families, around the environmental fallout. And in fact, the last time we had you on with Jenna Orkin, who talked about the horrible cover-up of the EPA in New York and the lingering damage that's still going on for first responders and health effects. But you wanted to come on and remind us and remind our listeners, not in an alarmist way and certainly not in a propagandistic way. 9/11 still matters, so we can go and fight these wars and we need to be very afraid of people. You wanted to come and talk about why 9/11 still matters, I think, in other contexts. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about your work around this issue?
The work that I've done over the years has been very simple: to support the family seeking truth, accountability, and justice, to support the 9/11 first responders seeking permanent help because of the environmental impact of 9/11, and to try and stop the wars and the national security state using the truth about 9/11, something that we have been denied and something we still don't have. The simple question of why does 9/11 still matter is because the unsolved mass murder of 2,977 plus people, and that's a good reason, but there's more to it than that. You mentioned the 9/11 first responders. I want to quickly mention the Victims' Compensation Fund, which was started after 9/11 to give help to people financially and so forth. And they're running out of funds, and the 9/11 first responders and people of New York and so forth need that assistance in order to survive, to keep going. So they've been fighting to get the VCF, the Victim Compensation Fund, made permanent so that they all have help financially that they need and so forth.
And I know, John, you've been doing a lot of work around that and around the victims' families. But you mentioned earlier that we still don't know exactly what happened. Let's go into a little more detail about that. So for our listeners, because that means many different things for many different people, including some very outlandish and unsupportable things. But we also have to remind our listeners that the 9/11 Commission report also was full of half-truths and unbelievable bits of information we were supposed to swallow while ignoring important other points. Can you go into some detail about some of those issues? Or
there were a number of whistleblowers that the 9/11 Commission didn't speak to. There were 70% of the families' questions that were never answered. Philip Zelikow, who was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, was asked to resign twice by the families during the time of the 9/11 Commission because of a number of issues concerning him, and he refused, and he ended up doing a lot of things to cover up for the NSA, for Saudi Arabia, and a number of other issues. And people like activists such as myself, we do not have the power to put somebody on the stand under oath with the idea that they will be held accountable for lying. We don't have access to lie detectors. We don't have access to thousands upon thousands of documents that have yet to be declassified. And in regard to that, the families, the 9/11 families right now, are in the lawsuit against Saudi Arabia, and the Department of Justice is blocking access yet again to documentation that the families need in their lawsuit. One of the documents is called the 2012 FBI Summary Report. I believe the DOJ is either using state secrets privilege or just the idea of national security issue to maintain the classification of the pages. So the families are in a stalemate right now with the Department of Justice. Another lawsuit that has to do with the buildings, they tried to file suit to bring up, I think, a grand jury, and Bob McElveen, 9/11 family member Bob McElveen, is involved with that. And that has to do with the information concerning urban moving systems. And urban moving systems, for those who don't know, there was a story of celebrating Israelis on the day of 9/11. And for years, we didn't know whether or not those movers that were part of urban moving systems had foreknowledge of the event and were there to celebrate it ahead of time or something to that effect, or whether or not they were celebrating after the fact. And it seems, because of documentation that has just been released concerning the urban moving systems, photographs that have been released, that they may have had foreknowledge of the event. So why wasn't that covered by the 9/11 Commission? The little stories like that have come out over the years, and the 9/11 Commission simply did not cover. And their mandate was, quote, to give a full and complete accounting, end quote, of the attacks of 9/11 and to make recommendations as to how to prevent such attacks in the future. So everything they missed, again, shows that they failed in their mandate, shows that we don't know the truth about 9/11 and so forth.
John Gold, you were talking about an article from the New York Times about alleged 9/11 mastermind plotting. This was from a few months ago.
On March 25th, 2019, the New York Times released an article called U.S. Said to Have Tapes of Alleged 9/11 Mastermind Plotting with Co-Conspirators. That's from the New York Times. And here's a quote. Quote, military prosecutors say they have tapes of telephone calls between the alleged mastermind of the September 11th attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and three of his accused co-conspirators talking in code about the plot months before it took place, a defense lawyer disclosed on Monday, end quote. And this is something that we simply were not aware of. And this had to do with the trials going on at Guantanamo Bay. The prosecutors have these calls that we simply weren't made aware of. And as a result of the news that this came out, Jersey Girl and September 11th advocate Lori Van Auken sent a letter to the editor for the New York Times. And she wrote, quote, "Are the prosecutors actually saying there exist tapes of calls made in April to October of 2001, but divulged to defense lawyers only in 2016 that reveal the attack planning that have been kept secret from us until now? Question mark. And that calls, and that the calls' origins, methods of collecting them, and chain of custody can't be examined? One would have thought that the 9/11 Commission might have unearthed any 9/11 planning calls back in 2003 or 2004 when we family members were publicly pleading for this type of evidence. Why did it take until 2016 to mention the existence of these tapes? What was the National Security Agency doing with the tapes all this time? In what kind of code were the planners speaking? Will we ever get to hear the tapes or read the transcripts? We are in the 34th round of pretrial hearings and still no actual date has been set for the trial. Which parts of the Constitution apply? Maybe someone else besides us will finally take notice of these outrageous kangaroo court proceedings happening at Guantanamo Bay." And that was 9/11 family member Lori Van Auken, and she wrote that. It was published March 26, 2019 for the New York Times.
This is recent. This is a few months ago. But again, what you're bringing up here in context historically is this is 18 years later.
Exactly. And people need to be made aware that the 9/11 Commission barely investigated the National Security Agency, as was written about in Phil Sheehan's book, The Commission. I think they spent a day, maybe, at the NSA, and they found information that supposedly connected Iran to al-Qaeda and whatnot. Phil Sheehan wrote that it was sexier for them to focus on the CIA. For Philip Zelikow, it was sexier to focus on the CIA than the NSA. But we just don't know what the NSA knew.
Well, I don't think the NSA is probably going to tell us, John Gold. But one of the things that you're bringing up here is that there is a very selective way of looking at this investigation. And Philip Zelikow was steering it, guiding it. He was very clearly helping decide which things would be asked and not. That was a bone of contention all the way back then. One of the better documentaries done early on was, I believe, the Press for Truth. 9/11 Press for Truth that looked at the victims' families, because it looked at what a complete sham the commission was, and it looked at the conflicts of interest between Philip Zelikow, who's allegedly somehow part of a commission that's investigating his friend and professional colleague, Bush insider, Condoleezza Rice, and they'd written books together. And the lead counsel, I remember, and I bring this up often, the lead counsel of the 9/11 Commission, the legal counsel, the dean of law at Rutgers University, wrote a book called Whitewash, about how the 9/11 Commission was a whitewash from start to finish. So it's not as if this information hasn't been available to the American public, or to the world for that matter. It just begs for an actual investigation. We know we're not going to go back through the same channels and think we're going to get different results. We're joined on today's Project Censored show with activist and author John Gold, whose most recent book and podcast series of over 30 interviews with 9/11 experts, activists, authors, scientists, and more, is called We Were Lied To About 9/11. John Gold, before the break, we were rehashing some of the things that we should have known but didn't, some of the things that we still don't know and why. Let's spend a little bit of time, too, talking about what are some of your prescriptions. You're really close to some of these people. You've worked with some of these activists that were directly impacted by the 9/11 events. What are your prescriptions for things that people are already doing that you believe to be working? And what are some things that others can do? Because 9/11 historically gets further and further in the rearview mirror. And other than being taken out as a boogeyman to scare people for another war with another Arab or Muslim country that had nothing to do with it, we're not getting the serious inquiry. In fact, recently on the show, we had Nolan Higdon talking about some of his recent work, and he and I are actually working on an article for a journal publication on history as news. And one of the things we're looking at is how 9/11 is covered in American history textbooks. How are historians starting to look at 9/11? And John Gold, I have to tell you, and I know this won't surprise you, but they're looking at it in a very inaccurate and incomplete way, but they're also talking about it authoritatively, which I find as an historian to be very problematic. So what are your thoughts on that, and also on some of the things we could be doing and some of the things people are doing to have accurate positions and really know the facts about 9/11?
Well, obviously, what you can do is start reading on your own. There are a multitude of books out there to learn about 9/11. But my basic tenet has always been to support the families seeking truth, accountability, and justice, and the responders, and to try and show people that we were lied to about 9/11, which is not a complex thing to do. You can do it in a few words, if need be. For instance, we were told repeatedly after 9/11 that there were no warnings of any kind, that nobody had any idea that this was going to happen, that it was a complete surprise attack, that it was a new Pearl Harbor. And as we found out in May of 2002, there was just one warning called the August 6th Presidential Daily Briefing that talked about buildings in New York and 70 FBI field investigations currently taking place in the United States and other things. It talked about hijackings or other types of attacks and so forth. And that was just one warning, but they received so many warnings about things, so many that we don't know about. So that's just one way to show that we were lied to. You just got to try to do the right thing. As I mentioned, the families are in the lawsuit against Saudi Arabia. So be supportive of them. The news is not covering them to the extent that they should. And that has always been the problem in the establishment news. Every time the September 11th advocates had written a press release, it should have gotten Russiagate kind of coverage, but never has. There have been released piecemeal over the years. This issue concerning 9/11 happened, but there's no context given. Then a couple of years go by, and then this comes out. And people may not have caught the first thing that came out. So there's no context, when there are reports of this. So not everybody can put it together.
So, John, you mentioned that the families are at a legal standstill right now in regards to what information they can get regarding their family members. Is there any hope that you see that more and more information will eventually come out? Or do you think that what we have out now is pretty much what we're going to get?
I don't know. What I know is that right now the Florida Bulldog is trying to get 80,000 pages worth of documentation concerning a Sarasota incident involving Muhammad Atta and other things. The families are trying to get the documentation from the Department of Justice. What you could do is try to bring pressure on William Barr, for instance. But again, stuff like that, there's never any good result. I'm fairly certain that most of the additional powers that were granted to the executive, as well as to the different alphabet agencies since 9/11, have never reached what's called a sunset clause. Essentially, a national emergency was declared on 9/14/2001 and has been renewed by the executive branch every year since. And Trump renewed it on September 10th, 2018. And here's a quote from that document. Quote, because the terrorist threat continues, the national emergency declared on September 14th, 2001, and the powers and authorities adopted to deal with that emergency must continue in effect beyond September 14th, 2018. Therefore, I, Donald Trump, am continuing in effect for an additional year the national emergency declared on September 14th, 2001 in response to certain terrorist attacks. And I think that the wording is funny. Why don't they just say 9/11? They were given powers. And in Washington, D.C., when you're given power, you're not going to give it up. And it's going to pass on and pass on throughout administrations. So whatever powers the executive has been given, they still have. Also, there's something called the Authorization for Use of Military Force that was written after 9/11 to go specifically after those responsible for 9/11. And that is still in effect. So all of the wars, every single military action we've done in the name of the war on terror, the AUMF, or the Authorization for Use of Military Force, has been used as the legal justification for this. And the Smithsonian released a map that showed we are operating militarily in 80 different countries in the name of the war on terror. And that AUMF is also used, or has been used, as a legal justification for things like warrantless wiretapping or indefinite detention. The Supreme Court just ruled they're not going to hear the arguments having to do with indefinite detention inside of Guantanamo Bay. So many things that we hate about the national security state are legally justified by the Authorization for Use of Military Force. And I know that Barbara Lee is trying to have them rewrite a new one so that the old one for 9/11 can't still be used. No. I say no. No more authorization for use of military force. We don't need it anymore. We've killed enough innocent people in this world in the name of 9/11. We don't need to do it anymore. We don't need to kill more people. So I say no to what Barbara Lee suggests. As I said, every war that we've taken part in or every military action has been done in the name of 9/11 and has gotten us to this point. So if they want to create a new authorization for use of military force for, say, something like war with Iran, no, just no, no more war.
John Gold, you bring up a very interesting point there about how the executive powers came to be after 9/11 and how they never seem to leave, because what new president is going to want to have less powers than the president before them? That's why I think it's so important that more information come out around what we knew about these types of attacks before it happened, because the argument that the state makes is that we need the NSA, we need these types of places like Guantanamo Bay where we can interrogate or torture people to get the information out of them so that we see these attacks coming next time. But what it sounds like you're saying is that there's evidence that we did have knowledge about these types of attacks possibly coming and that there was sufficient preparation. And so, in a sense, none of these new war powers are necessary in the first place.
The September 11th attacks, there were a multitude of warnings that were coming in. For instance, Bush not only received the August 6th presidential daily briefing in 2001, he received 39 other presidential daily briefings having to do with al-Qaeda prior to 9/11. As I said, every executive is going to keep the power that they had. The wars and the military actions are all legally justified using the 9/11 attack. So if we were lied to about that day, there's no justification for any of the military action going on. It's just going to continue. And as I was saying earlier, Barbara Lee is fighting for a rewritten authorization for use of military force. And I say no. We've killed enough people in this world that have absolutely nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. And so enough is enough. No more war, no more national security state. I'm not suggesting that there shouldn't be precautions to make sure that we don't have a terrorist attack in the future. But there's no reason to keep all the warnings and the information concerning the 9/11 attacks, something that happened 18 years ago, secret anymore. And, you know, they still use this excuse that there's an ongoing investigation and that they cannot release this or that, or can't comment. And that's just absurd at this point, just absolutely absurd.
And so, John, it seems like from the U.S. government's perspective, there's two very obvious reasons why they would not want more information regarding 9/11 to come out. One would be they definitely want to be able to hold on to these executive powers that have come since September 11th. And the other is possibly just a sense of embarrassment for having had information showing that this type of attack might take place and not being able to stop it or protect the American people.
Well, I've always looked at 9/11 as a crime and not an act of war. And as with every crime, there are suspects for that crime. And I believe there's enough information that exists that says not only was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed a suspect for the crime of 9/11, but I think that elements within our government and other governments may have been criminally complicit as well. And they've earned the title, more than earned the title of suspect for the crime of 9/11. There's a third possibility that I don't discard simply because it's scary to people. And I don't think others should discard it as well, the possibility.
And of course, John Gold, in your series, We Were Lied to About 9/11, people can learn about this at wewereliedtoabout911.com. You interviewed 30-some experts on these issues talking about issues surrounding 9/11. Most of the issues that you raise escape the attention of corporate media and the establishment press. I mentioned Jenna Orkin earlier. Ray Novosielski, who was one of the people behind the Press for Truth film, also has a new book out on 9/11. You talked to Colleen Rowley, the FBI whistleblower, family member Lori Van Auken, his scholar Nafis Ahmed, activist Cindy Sheehan, NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake, scholar Peter Dale Scott, Abby Martin, Peter Phillips, Senator Bob Graham, and of course, Paul Thompson from the timeline. Right. So again, I urge listeners, again, if you really want to dive deeply in here and see what's going on and what we're missing about 9/11, John Gold is a great source for that. And John Gold, I want to thank you for your activism and your work around it. And again, kudos to you for putting together this big series and this publication we relied to about 9/11. So your work is appreciated.
And your work at Project Censored and everything else you do, Mickey and Chase, is greatly appreciated. I love Project Censored, and I hope it never ends.
Thanks for your kind words and well wishes. We will certainly continue our work at projectcensored.org. You can learn more. We were lied to about 9/11.com. John Gold, thanks for rejoining us in the Project Censored show. I'm sure we'll be catching up with you again soon.
Thank you, guys.
That wraps up our conversation with author and activist John Gold. After this break, we will hear about a recent update. TV personality and comedian Jon Stewart recently spoke to the House Judiciary Committee, shaming it for its inadequate aid to ill September 11th first responders. And then we'll be back with an update on the flag burning as free speech court case. Stay with us.
Fierce and ingenious, a poetic specter so far gone that every jackass newscaster was struck dumb and stumbling over, "Oh my God, and this is unbelievable," and on and on. And I'll tell you what, while we're at it, you can keep the Pentagon, you can keep the propaganda, you can keep each and every TV that's been trying to convince me to participate in some prep school punk's plan to perpetuate retribution. Perpetuate retribution. Even as the blue toxic smoke of our lesson in retribution is still hanging in the air, and there's ash on our shoes, and there's ash in our hair, and there's a fine silt on every mantle from Hell's Kitchen to Brooklyn, and the streets are full of stories, sudden twists and near misses, and soon every open bar is crammed to the rafters with tales of narrowly averted disasters, and the whiskey is flowing like never before, as all over the country folks just shake their heads. Poor.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. In this segment of the program, relating to the last segueing about why 9/11 still matters and issues of first responders, TV personality and comedian Jon Stewart recently returned to Congress to speak to the House Judiciary Committee. That was on June 10. And he spoke from the witness table, and many in the audience behind him were former first responders, now ill from exposure to smoke and toxic dust from the fallen Twin Towers. Listeners of this program, of course, will remember that Stewart, nearly 10 years ago, his presence in media and on The Daily Show at the time called much-needed attention to congressional inaction to fund the health care for those who were ill from the toxic dust at Ground Zero on 9/11. Stewart returns and brings the mighty shame of truth, and we are sharing that public testimony with you here.
I want to thank Mr. Collins and Mr. Naylor for putting this together, but as I sit here today, I can't help but think what an incredible metaphor this room is for the entire process that getting health care and benefits for 9/11 first responders has come to. Behind me, a filled room of 9/11 first responders, and in front of me, a nearly empty Congress. Sick and dying, they brought themselves down here to speak to no one. It's shameful. It's an embarrassment to the country, and it is a stain on this institution. And you should be ashamed of yourselves for those that aren't here, but you won't be, because accountability doesn't appear to be something that occurs in this chamber. We don't want to be here. Lou doesn't want to be here. None of these people want to be here, but they are, and they're not here for themselves. They're here to continue fighting for what's right. Lou's going to go back for his 69th chemo. The great Ray Pfeiffer would come down here, his body riddled with cancer and pain, where he couldn't walk. And the disrespect shown to him and to the other lobbyists on this bill is utterly unacceptable. You know, I would be so angry at the latest injustice that's done to these men and women. And, you know, another business card thrown our way as a way of shooing us away. Like children trick-or-treating. rather than the heroes that they are and will always be. Ray would say, calm down, Johnny, calm down. I got all the cards I need. And he would tap his pocket where he kept the prayer cards, 343 firefighters. The official FDNY response time to 9/11 was 5 seconds. 5 seconds. That's how long it took for FDNY, for NYPD, for Port Authority, for EMS to respond to an urgent need from the public. 5 seconds. Hundreds died in an instant. Thousands more poured in to continue to fight for their brothers and sisters. The breathing problem started almost immediately, and they were told they weren't sick, they were crazy. And then, as the illnesses got worse and things became more apparent, well, okay, you're sick, but it's not from the pile. And then, when the science became irrefutable, okay, it's the pile, but this is a New York issue. I don't know if we have the money. And I'm sorry if I sound angry and undiplomatic, but I'm angry, and you should be too, and they're all angry as well. And they have every justification to be that way. There is not a person here, there is not an empty chair on that stage that didn't tweet out, never forget the heroes of 9/11. Never forget their bravery. Never forget what they did, what they gave to this country. Well, here they are. And where are they? And it would be one thing if their callous indifference and rank hypocrisy were benign, but it's not. Your indifference costs these men and women their most valuable commodity. Time. It's the one thing they're running out of. This should be flipped. This hearing should be flipped. These men and women should be up on that stage, and Congress should be down here answering their questions as to why this is so damn hard and takes so damn long, and why no matter what they get, something's always pulled back and they got to come back. Mr. Johnson, you made a point earlier, and it was one that we have heard over and over again in these halls, and I couldn't help but to answer to it, which was, you said, look, you know, you guys are obviously heroes, and 9/11 was a big deal, but, you know, we have a lot of stuff here to do, and, you know, we got to make sure there's money for a variety of disasters, hurricanes and tornadoes, but this wasn't a hurricane, and this wasn't a tornado, and by the way, that's your job anyway. We can't fund these programs, you can. Setting aside that no American in this country should face financial ruin because of a health issue, certainly 9/11 first responders shouldn't have to decide whether to live or to have a place to live. And the idea that you can only give them 5 more years of the VCF because you're not quite sure what's going to happen 5 years from now, well, I can tell you, I'm pretty sure what's going to happen 5 years from now. More of these men and women are going to get sick and they are going to die. And I am awfully tired of hearing that it's a 9/11 New York issue. Al-Qaeda didn't shout death to Tribeca. They attacked America. And these men and women and their response to it is what brought our country back. It's what gave a reeling nation a solid foundation to stand back upon, to remind us of why this country is great, of why this country is worth fighting for. And you are ignoring them. And you can end it tomorrow. Why this bill isn't unanimous consent and a standalone issue is beyond my comprehension. And I have yet to hear a reasonable explanation for why. It'll get stuck in some transportation bill or some appropriations bill and get sent over to the Senate, where a certain someone from the Senate will use it as a political football to get themselves maybe another new import tax on petroleum, because that's what happened to us in 2015. And we won't allow it to happen again. Thank God for people like John Feel. Thank God for people like Ray Pfeiffer. Thank God for all of these people who will not let it happen. They responded in 5 seconds. They did their jobs with courage, grace, tenacity, humility, 18 years later, do yours. Thank you.
Once Stewart gave the address, within a day, the committee unanimously voted to fund the compensation. On this segment of the program, we are delighted to be rejoined by Gregory Joey Johnson. A number of years ago, we had the, I would say, fortune of interviewing, even though it was under unfortunate circumstances, we had the opportunity to interview Joey Johnson. He was part of a group of protesters at the Republican National Convention, where Donald Trump was nominated, where a number of people were involved in burning the American flag in protest. Now, the reason that I'm setting this up is that Johnson is the same defendant in the landmark 1989 Supreme Court case, Texas v. Johnson, which determined flag burning was protected speech. And we are joined again here by Joey Johnson because he was just handed a decisive victory against the city of Cleveland for the right to protest by burning an American flag. And let's go in and get a little bit more of that history, and then Joey Johnson will bring us up to speed on this recent case. Joey Johnson, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Well, thank you, Mickey. It's great to be with you.
You have such a long history on the front lines of the First Amendment with the seminal case, Texas v. Johnson, going back to 1989, the Supreme Court case. Could you remind our listeners of the context of that case and the outcome?
Well, 1984, the Republican National Convention, when Ronald Reagan was being renominated. Myself, I was a young revolutionary communist and an internationalist, and I went to Dallas to protest. It seemed like the important thing to do because Reagan was being nominated, and give people a sense of Reagan. It's like Trump is Reagan on steroids, fascist steroids. But Reagan had did crimes against humanity. You know, nowadays he's looked at in this avuncular way, but he did horrific things to people around the world, most immediately in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala, where he backed death squads that massacred. I mean, if people want to understand the refugee crisis today, a lot of its antecedents or its roots are what the U.S. did in Central America in the 1980s, still today causing millions of people to need to flee their homelands and to try to come here as refugees. It was our responsibility to go there and call that out and denounce it. And I did it from the standpoint of this whole system of American capitalism and imperialism is a crime against humanity, an ongoing crime against humanity. They have the city laid out thick with American flags. It had that Nuremberg rally atmosphere, and burning it was a concentrated expression of contempt and disgust for this empire and for its crimes against humanity. So I'm glad we did that. I'm proud we did that. It was a way to stand with the people of the world, and I'm from here. This is where I was born, but I don't identify with this country. I identify with the people of the world and emancipating humanity, getting humanity beyond borders and identification, especially when you live in a country that oppresses large parts of the earth and imposes its domination with its military might and its economic system extracts wealth and exploits people all over the planet in sweatshops and mines and you name it. So that's what we did in 1984. And I got arrested and convicted in a Dallas courtroom and sentenced to a year in jail and a $2,000 fine. I fought it on appeal for 5 years all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And my attorney, as some of you might recall, in when I went to the Supreme Court, was William Kunstler, radical attorney of the 1960s. And so it was a tremendous honor to be represented by him. And because he not only wanted to fight the case in the legal arena, but also out in society to have people grasp the stakes that were involved. And it was quite a battle. And the ruling of the court was 5-4 that my burning of the flag was symbolic speech and constitutionally protected political speech. It wasn't a gift. It was that was handed to me. It was a fight all the way through. But then the reaction to it was severe and intense, because it ranged from the then George Herbert Walker Bush, who was the president at the time in 1989, calling for a constitutional amendment against the Supreme Court's decision and to criminalize flag burning. And then Congress reacted, and keep this name in mind, Joe Biden, by calling for a new federal statute against flag burning. So that those were the terms that they tried to cast things in society. And the new federal statute was enacted. And so we immediately went out and defied it, burning flags on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. And some folks out in Seattle, Washington also burned flags. So then there was a second case that went back to the U.S. Supreme Court. And then when that case, it was also overturned, or the convictions were overturned, then Bush again called for the constitutional amendment. It was only very narrowly defeated, and it's been proposed just about every year since then. So it's been an ongoing fight, and it's an important fight because we need to reject this American first chauvinism, whether it's in the form of Trump is very direct and belligerent about it. He campaigned on that at the 2016 Republican National Convention. But even before him, that's the way people are trained to think in this country: America first, American chauvinism. And it's predatory and parasitic, you know, off the suffering of literally, you know, billions of people around the world.
We're speaking with Gregory Joey Johnson. Joey Johnson was just recapping for us and reminding listeners of the Texas v. Johnson case back to 1989, the events that led up to that, of course, going back to the 1984 Republican convention that nominated Ronald Reagan. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show, and I'm your host, Mickey Huff. So I don't remember if I told you this, Joey Johnson, when we last met and spoke, right around the time that you were involved with the Republican National Convention in Cleveland in 2016 that nominated Donald Trump. But your case, your events, I came of political age in the 1980s during the Reagan years. I vividly remember the Reagan years and how much it really kind of shaped my awareness of political culture. And your case in particular, as a longtime musician, your case in particular sparked a song. I actually wrote a song about your case. I was 18 years old at the time. That was 1989.
What was the title?
Cog, C-O-G, like being a cog in the wheel, right? And one of the stark lyrics that I remember was, "Why is it so much more important to have a symbol than the thing that it stands for?" Pretty remarkable that in a country that alleges to have such principles of protecting free speech and expression, that you would have to fight tooth and nail against the establishment, including both major parties who were trying to criminalize free speech. And just personally, I'd like to thank you for all the work that you've done and all that you've done over the years to fight for the First Amendment and fight for this principle for all of us.
That's an interesting story. I think that there's a lot of mythology in this country about the freedom of expression that we allegedly have. I mean, I think the point is when you say something that matters, here they come. I mean, look what they did to Colin Kaepernick around his refusal to stand for the national anthem and his wanting to take a knee because of the oppression of black people and all the black people that are brutally murdered or brutalized at the hands of the police across the country, the other people of color brutalized by the police. And so he wants to make a statement about that. You know, there's flags all over the place when you go to NFL games. They have military flyovers. They have soldiers in uniforms strategically seated at the 50-yard line so they can be caught on camera frequently. This flood of patriotism. There it is, jingoism. And yet when one player goes against the grain, they come down on him with a hammer precisely because they know that these sentiments can become contagious. And, you know, this is what I've been going through for several decades now. And even though there was a Supreme Court decision, you know, when we went to Cleveland, we had a sense that this momentum that was building around Trump was very dangerous. You know, Trump's like a fascist jackass. There he is, you know, up there spewing out all this white supremacy, this ethnic cleansing, this derogatory comments about Mexicans and immigrants and Muslims and women. He's a misogynist in chief. And so this is all going down, and we had a sense that we had to, again, do this, make us kind of a powerful condemnation. And I announced that I was going to do it 2 days prior in a public press release, the named defendant in Texas versus Johnson, the Supreme Court's decision that said you had a right to do this, was going to be doing it. And yet the Cleveland police still, they did what Trump is doing overall with the rule of law. If he doesn't like it, he ignores it. And they came crashing into a safety circle we had set up, a safety circle so that no one would be, endangered or harmed. And I was standing in the center of the safety circle, and I gave a short speech. I talked about Trump says America first, and I said America always has been first at slavery, at genocide, at wars of empire, at occupations, at coup d'etats, at tortures, at torture, at destruction of the global environment. And I said, we're standing with the people of the world. And then I set the flag on fire. And so here come these Cleveland police, even before it was really burning. I mean, it did burn, but they're crashing in with fire extinguishers. They put me in a chokehold. They arrested 16 people in total and put us in handcuffs and took us to jail and kept us there until the convention was over with. This was like, to hell with the law. We're gonna do this, was their attitude. So we fought the criminal charges for more than a year and a half. It took 6 months to get my charges dropped. And there's a little corner to that story I should tell your audience, which is two InfoWars reactionaries were also part of attacking our protest, the Alex Jones psychopaths. So they come at us, and after I'm arrested in jail, and I'm asking, like, I'm trying to figure out what I'm charged with. And later I saw the arrest reports, and they had repeatedly scratched out the charges that they were recommending, from aggravated arson to aggravated disorderly conduct, aggravated resisting. They scratched all of that out. And what they arrived at was supposedly misdemeanor assault on two members of the media. And I find out when I get out that it's actually two members of InfoWars claimed that the burning flag came across their hands. But they stupidly that night posted a video where they bragged about going down there to assault me and to stop me from burning the flag. So how can you be a victim of assault when you're bragging about having gone down there to commit an assault? So that was part of how my charges got dropped. But then the charges against the other 15 people, including two people that had serious felonies, had to be fought. So I'm going on a long time, but it's quite a story. So after all of that, the charges were dropped against everyone. And then I immediately followed a civil rights suit for wrongful arrest and retaliation. And so that was a year and a half ago.
We're joined for this segment by Joey Johnson. He was a defendant in the landmark 1989 Texas versus Johnson Supreme Court case that determined flag burning was considered free speech, protected free speech. Fast forward, Joey Johnson was telling us how he was one of the RNC 16, one of the protesters at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio, at 2016, where Donald Trump was nominated to be that party's candidate for president. Joey Johnson was arrested there for burning the flag again and was just now sharing how his charges were eventually dropped. But Joey Johnson, you were going to continue the story. And again, I want to allow our listeners to hear more of the details, because your story is important and it does have even more current, very recent developments that I understand certainly went in your favor. So please continue.
Well, the point I was trying to make about the outcome of the criminal cases, we had a First Amendment evidentiary hearing, which is an unusual thing to occur in misdemeanor cases. But after about 8 months, the judge issued his ruling, and the ruling, the justification of the judge for dropping the charges against all the defendant included in part a reference to the decision in my 1989 Supreme Court case that said we had the right to do this. So then we go into a civil lawsuit realm. I didn't know that it was going to turn into that. I had no idea, but it's one way to hold them accountable for what they did. And after about a year and a half, there was a settlement of $225,000, almost $250,000. The city of Cleveland and the Cleveland police are still denying liability, but that's pretty common. I think that the size of the settlement speaks loudly that they were at fault, and what they were concerned about would come out at trial if the case went to trial. I think it was a good outcome.
Well, it's a very important case, a very important outcome, and you're quite right. Oftentimes, you'll see these kinds of settlements so that the guilty parties never have to cop to it, pun intended, I guess. But they then say that, well, we didn't do this, but here's a settlement for you, so we're technically not guilty, but they basically want you to go away because they fear the outcome of a potential jury trial.
And I wanted your listeners to know that in the wake of the decision in Cleveland or the settlement, the New York Times carried a pretty major article based on an interview with me and with some constitutional law professors. It was a very favorable article overall, and it counterposed against Trump once again calling for a constitutional amendment or supporting the call for a constitutional amendment. So my case and the outcome of the civil case in Cleveland is situated in this larger fight that's going on. Trump's constitutional amendment against flag burning is a constitutional amendment against the First Amendment, because at the heart of the First Amendment is your right to criticize the government. And that's what's under attack. And if they can say that you can't criticize a symbol of the government, that's a small step away from saying you can't criticize the government.
Well, it's a huge. It would be a huge blow to free expression.
And right in the wake of the same day as the New York Times articles posted, Trump's putting out his call supporting a constitutional amendment that's been proposed by a senator from Montana. So, you know, I want to say we're coming up on the 4th of July, and the orientation of the Revolution Club is we need an actual revolution to uproot this whole system of American capitalism and imperialism and the crimes it does throughout the world. The flag is a symbol of a system, and it's the system itself that's actually got to be overthrown. It's going to require millions of people to do that. We don't have millions of people, but that's something that we're working on, and we want people whose curiosity or whose outrage and indignation about so many crimes of empire. I mean, I was just reading the news accounts about the young man in Vallejo who was shot 53 times. Circumstances that were very similar reminded me of what happened to Taisha Miller down in Riverside several decades ago. I think for your listeners, you know, this is the flag that flies over the concentration camps on the border where children are crying and even dying. This is the same rag that blesses the bombs and the planes and the troops that have murdered and mangled hundreds of thousands of children in Iraq and Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen. This is the flag flying over the mass incarceration in this country with 2 million people. I'm watching this new film about the Central Park Five, When They See Us. This is the flag that flew over that. It flies over it's on the shoulder patch of the police that gun down people across the country in the thousands every year, especially Black and Latino and Native American. And it's a rare, rare moment when anyone is ever held accountable. They just do it with impunity.
Well, I think that's what makes your cases even more significant and important, because I think that they're vehicles to remind those of us, not just those of us who pay attention, but to the many people who don't understand the case or who have a knee-jerk reaction to your political expression, not realizing the irony of how the flag they worship and wrap themselves in is also symbolic of the very rights you have to burn it in your expression.
I just want to say to your listeners, this point I made about we need an actual revolution, there's a quote from Bob Avakian, the leader of the revolution, where he says, if you can conceive of a world without America, about everything America stands for, everything it does in the world, then you've already taken great strides and begun to get at least a glimpse of a whole new world. If you can envision a world without any imperialism, exploitation, oppression, and the whole philosophy that rationalizes it, a world without division into classes or even different nations, and all the narrow-minded, selfish, outmoded ideas that uphold this, if you can envision all this, then you have the basis for proletarian internationalism. And once you have raised your sights to all this, how could you not feel compelled to take an active part in a world historic struggle to realize it? Why would you want to lower your sights to anything else? So I'm asking people to think about that, and to think about it this 4th of July, and to not only conceive of a world without America, but to fight and work for that world. And this whole thing about the flag being soaked with blood of barbarity and hypocrisy, as Frederick Douglass used to say, mm-hmm. It needs to burn in other places around the country. And I plan on doing that, and I hope others will too.
Well, Joey Johnson, Howard Zinn, the late great historian Howard Zinn, once said that there is no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people. I think you've summed that up pretty well, along, of course, with Frederick Douglass. Joey Johnson, thanks so much for your 30-year efforts, really standing up for the First Amendment and trying to convey to people not just the importance of what those rights mean, but also pointing out the problems of false patriotism and really try to prompt people to think critically about what the flag that so many people salute really stands for. So I just wanted to thank you for your work and thank you for your time. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our audience as we conclude this segment? Any website or social media or anywhere people can follow you or learn more?
I just really want to encourage your listeners to go to www.revcom.us, and on Twitter they can go to @tuneintorevcom, and they can write me at joey4revolution@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. And again, thanks for your work in these important cases over 30 years. Also, although it sounds odd to say, congratulations for your recent victory in the settlement from the city of Cleveland for $225,000 for basically admitting that they violated your First Amendment rights. So, Joey Johnson, thanks again, and we will likely be having you on the program in the future to talk about related issues.
Okay. All right, Mickey. It's good to hear your voice. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Joey.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, and host of the program. Our co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Best is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Project Censored Show airs on nearly 50 stations around the United States, from Hawaii to New England. To learn more about our work and find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast app. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. And last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges, and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons.